Thank you. There is no end to the blessing I have this week. I haven't seen Charlie for months, and twice within a week I'm in the same room as him, not just this morning, but we're both part of the General Synod of the Church of England, lucky and blessed men as we are. And on Tuesday evening, Monday evening maybe it was, we were in a gathering for kind of Aldate C. Ebsey type Anglicans there talking to one another. Now, one of the things you need to realise about the General Synod is that when you stand up and speak, this being the Church of England, of course, you need to introduce yourself properly. And so you stand up and say, Canon Charles Cleverly, Oxford 188, or whatever your name and synod number happens to be. Mark Tanner, Northern Suffragans 52, which is my synod number, not my age. And I only mention that because I'm the only bishop in synod where the latter is lower than the former. But in this particular gathering, there was kind of a game that was being played. And so rather than saying the normal thing, people stood up and said something like, Justin Welby, sinner saved by grace. He wasn't there, but I couldn't think who else might be in synod that you'd know the name of. And had he been there, he absolutely would have said it. Mark Tanner, sinner saved by grace. And I sat there having spotted Charlie and recognised him through this new beard that he sprouted since I last saw him. Shows how long 2 years you've had it. Thinking, do you know, that's the only introduction I really need to give on Sunday when I'm preaching at St Aldate's. Because it's the only thing that really matters. Mark Tanner, sinner, saved by grace. Sinner. And I say it not through some false humility, not because I want you to be impressed with how humble I am, but because it is absolutely true, and it's the only way we can start on this extraordinary adventure of goodness, of life, of hope, of forgiveness, of freedom, of treasure that God has for us in Christ Jesus. Do not let yourself be distracted by this bling. Listen to my kids who refer to Dad's dressing up cupboard rather than to the Church of England, who refer to ecclesiastical, episcopal vesture and associated liturgical paraphernalia or whatever it happens to be. Do not be blinded by the stuff, be it in the church or by money in the world or by academia or by rank in the armed forces. The truth is that life starts when we recognize that we are fallen and we are broken. Mark Tanner, sinner, saved by grace. Jesus has never and will never give up on me. I remember aged 8 when I first realized the truth of this and accepted God's gracious invitation to make life with him as an 8-year-old boy 13 years ago. Assuming that within a few years I would have this down pat, that I would work out, because I wasn't that bad after all. I'd never sworn and I'd never murdered anyone and I'd never committed adultery. Not that I knew what adultery was aged 8, but I just assumed that I would have it. Do you know, the older I get, the more I realize I break the Father's heart with my envious, selfish, self-centered, proud, arrogant kind of ways. With my placing of myself first and my overlooking of the least, the lowest, and the lost, I'm a sinner. But I've been saved by grace that started with those very tiny seeds and which have grown over the years. I met my wife here last millennium in this church, sitting about here, and we used to face that way. In fact, I remember sitting on that windowsill at carol services because there were no pews spare in the place. I have a real sense within me, which I just want to confess to you, that as I come back and preach here, that I need to give good account of myself years after leaving. But I have to look you in the eye and say, the truth is that I have found discipleship and ministry really tough over those years. I think I've got more things wrong than I've got right. And in so doing, I have found myself in exactly the place that the apostle finds himself here in 2 Corinthians 4 as he's writing to the church in Corinth. You probably know enough to know that Paul and the Corinthians have not had an easy relationship, that the Corinthians have found themselves led astray by the so-called super apostles, that they have this kind of triumphalist understanding of what it is to be a follower of Christ. So they say you are rich, and you might remember elsewhere, Paul writes, already you are rich, already you have all that you want. That's fantastic, but I am the least of all at the very end of the procession. And he picks up this theme in 2 Corinthians 4. I've been oppressed in every way. All these things have happened to me. I carry in my body the cross, the death of Christ, but I do not lose heart because I might be a sinner and the world might be lined up against me, but I am saved by grace. The light of the glorious gospel of Christ has shone out through me and in you. It is an extraordinary treasure, a pearl beyond price. And Paul has discovered it and led others that they might discover it, and therefore he will not lose heart. And I only really want to say two things to you this morning, and they're very complicated, so you might need to write them down, but pin back your ears because they are really, really important. Firstly, if you have discovered Christ, you have treasure which is beyond your wildest imagination. You have not yet begun to glimpse even the very edges of the richness of the treasure that you have in Christ, however long you've been a Christian, and whatever extraordinary things you have seen God doing. His grace is more and more and more abundant than you can possibly imagine. It's the spiritual equivalent of Andrex toilet tissue. It goes on and on and on and on and on, and it never runs out. It's like driving up the A1 north towards Berwick. You might think you've got there, but then you realize you haven't even yet got to Birmingham. It just goes on. You have treasure which is beyond your wildest imagination. And secondly, you have it in jars of clay. I have to say to you, Oxford, in my experience, was a really weird place to be. I was an undergraduate here in the early 90s. And I found myself caught between two things that I have subsequently recognized are really dangerous spiritual traps. On the one side, I felt like because I was an undergraduate at Oxford University, I was the very creme de la creme. That something in the kind of atmosphere just gave me the impression that I could walk into any room and be the brightest and the best. I'm probably alone in feeling that, but that's one of the things Oxford did in me. And yet at one and the same time, every single time I sat in a tutorial, I read mathematics across the road here at Christchurch, I knew that I was completely hopeless at mathematics, that I would never be the brightest mathematician in the room, probably even if I went back to primary school, that others, particularly my tute partner, was far, far better than I was. And my experience of Oxford was I got pulled in both of those directions. And I have to say to you, they are both perils. A chap called Simon Walker, who was rep with me at Christchurch at the time, wrote a fantastic book called The Undefended Leader. In it, he says this: the truth is, you're nowhere near as good as you think you are, but you're nowhere near as bad as you fear you are. You're actually a beautiful child of God, full of the glorious reflection of the image of God, more loved than you have yet begun to imagine, and in him richer and fuller, more powerful and more able than you've ever realized you can be. For you, like me, if you've said yes to Christ, are a sinner saved by grace. You have treasure. It's in jars of clay. I remember arriving in the Diocese of Sheffield. Incidentally, if you get on the train near where I live and head south for 3 hours, you pull into Sheffield. I'm proper north. And I know I've just said something quite shocking, but yes, we do have trains in the northeast. We needed something for the pit ponies to pull when they shut the mines down. I remember arriving age 30 as the youngest incumbent in the diocese going to be vicar of the Red Light District. And I knew what I was going to. And so when I was walking down into town 2 or 3 days after I'd been plumbed in as vicar, wearing a clerical collar and everything, when I heard a voice behind me say the words I knew were going to be said, I was ready to respond. As the lady, whose name I'd later discover was Rachel, said to me, "Do you want any business, love?" I turned around. And I knew that I had 20 answers in my head. And in my imagination, pompous fool though I was, When I gave my killer line, she would fall to her knees and say, I have seen the error of my ways. Show me the light of Christ. But of course, what happened on that dark winter's evening in Doncaster was I turned around and my mind went completely blank. I mean, completely blank, so my mouth was flapping. I don't know if you've ever been in that kind of situation. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and she went, well? And I came out with just an extraordinary line in the heat of the moment. If you want to write it down and use it, if you're ever in the same situation, there's no copyright. I said, oh, no, not me, I'm the vicar. To which, quick as a flash, she said, that's all right, love, I've had plenty of them. And I said, well, you're not having me. And I literally ran away from my first conversation with one of the 26 girls who worked on the streets of my new parish. And as I ran, I found myself not externally but internally weeping, knowing that I was a complete and utter failure. You see, a few days before I'd been plumbed in, it was about 3 days after we moved into the vicarage, and my children at that stage were 3 months and 18 years old. Sorry, 18 years, 3 months and 18 months old. And we'd finally fallen asleep. It was a fairly exhausting time having just moved house with two very young children. And at about 2 o'clock in the morning, the dogs started going ballistic downstairs. And I leapt awake thinking, don't wake the kids, I need my sleep and Lindsay will kill me. And went downstairs and peeped through the little peephole, you know, in the middle of the front door you sometimes get in these old Victorian houses. And I saw somebody tinkering with my car. Well, there are sins and there are sins, but that's a sin. And I opened the door and I gave him some pastoral advice at a fairly clear volume and in a certainly assertive kind of way. And this man, who later I'd come to know as Davy Boy, kind of straightened up and started making his way towards me with this kind of... And the waves of alcohol fumes and other less legal noxious substances that were coming off him were quite extraordinary. And I stood there in my, albeit fine, dressing gown and knocking knees pajamas, was thinking, it's 2 o'clock in the morning in the red light district of Doncaster. My wife and kids are asleep upstairs, and the dog who's been barking is a complete coward. And Davy Boy got closer and closer and closer to me, and it was very clear that he'd decided he was coming in for at least a cup of tea. And I exercised what in the trade we call percussive pastoral care. I didn't quite thump him. But it wasn't very far from that. And as he recoiled, not at the physical strength of the puny pyjama-clad vicar, but I think in shock that somebody had hit him in a vicarage and slammed the door in his face, yelling, I'm going to call the police, I literally leant against the side of the hallway and slid down the wall, partly with the adrenaline, but mainly with the utter knowledge that I could not do this job. That I was beyond a failure as a priest in that place. And those two very early experiences led me to realize that the truth is that Mark is no man's superhero. And that if ever I am seeking to make the church in my own image, I am only committing idolatry. That the treasure is in jars of clay, as St. Paul says here, in order that the truth might be evident that the hope only comes from Christ. You have extraordinary treasure, but God deliberately places it in jars of clay because you are not the ones who are going to change the world. And if you do, there is a real danger that in forming the world, or still worse, the church in your image, that you too commit idolatry. And forgive me if I stumble over that word. One of my favorite memories of this church is of David McInnes preaching in the pulpit that used to be there, taking off his glasses and saying, I commit adultery. If you commit adultery, we all commit adultery all the time. And us sitting there and looking at Claire, his wife, thinking, I hope you said the wrong word. It is idolatrous if we give the impression that we can do it. We have this treasure in jars of clay. Thus began 6 years of ministry in Doncaster, which I knew that I could lead and coordinate and support, but I could not do it by myself, not least because the girls who worked our streets, all of whom were addicted to heroin, which is why they were working our streets, every time they saw me, because I am male, only saw a potential punter. And thus the key work that we were called to do as we ministered in that place could only actually be done by the women of the church. And so we started breakfast. We gave out presents of chocolate, because blood sugar is a real problem. We welcomed people into church. I remember a year or so before we left, we were doing one of these weird Church of England things where you welcome children into communion before they're confirmed. It was a much bigger thing back in those days. And I was sitting in my vicar's stall just before the service started, and down here on these three pews right at the front were three young ladies who we knew well. One had grown up in the church, one had very recently come to faith with her family, which is just wonderful, and one had kind of wandered in through the Sunday school over the last 3 or 4 years. They'd all decided to dress in white, and they were just this vision of the hope of the church. Just, you know what it's like with the kind of young people who've grown up through the church. Oh, wonderful. And just before the service started, in walked, we'll call them Simon and Rachel, it doesn't really matter what their names were. Rachel was a girl who worked our street. She was heavily pregnant. Of course, nobody knew who the father was. Simon was her boyfriend and her pimp. She worked the streets and was still working the streets in order to feed both of their drug addiction. I mean, just the brokenness is extraordinary. And they sat down in the church warden's pews right at the back of church, which is a really big thing, but that's another story. As we went through the service, and I preached and presided at the Eucharist, at which the youngsters were then welcomed to their very first Eucharist. And of course, they were the first to come to the rail. And they knelt there in white with expectant faces and their hands held out to receive, in some real sense, the very presence of Christ himself. They were the first. And do you know who the last to come up were? It was Rachel and Simon. As they got up from their seats and weaved their way down the aisle and knelt at the communion rail. And I found myself in my dreadful formal priesty way thinking, what do I do? Are they communicant members of the Church of England or not? And the voice of the Spirit said in my ear, and behold, the last shall be like unto the first. That's the treasure. That's what Jesus does. That's what the light of the good news of Christ does in our world. It doesn't just come to people who are basically nice people like most of us in this room. It transforms the world from the bottom up. It goes to the least and the lowest and the lost, and it brings hope where there is absolutely no right to have hope. It brings purpose. It brings forgiveness. It brings restoration. This is Jesus, and this is Jesus's work. And the truth is that we are all called to it wherever the Lord calls us, now and in the future. And the vessel that God has given you to carry this in is a clay jar. I noticed three things about clay jars in this passage. Firstly, notice that jars is plural in the text. It might just be linguistic. You know, if Mark's got a jar and I've got a jar, then we've got this treasure in jars of clay. It might be that sense. But I think theologically there's something rather richer going on. For, well, let me not say it of you, but let me confess it of myself. I find that all too often I live in fear. Fear of a God who is angry and retributive in a way the scriptures just don't present him to be. As if I somehow need to keep my jar together, because if I broke it, I've lost my final chance. As if I need to hide my weakness, because if others realize how clay my jar is, then they might just give up on me and walk out of the room. And we know that's not true. But it's only when we begin to discover it and trust it that God reworks the clay of our lives in a beautiful and holy and cleansing way. And I love the fact this word is plural, because with Christ, there is always hope. And I have a really strong suspicion that there are some in this room this morning who think secretly you probably blew your chance with God years ago because the clay shattered. And God wants to say to you this morning, I'm in the business of revealing new clay in your life. Because you're fragile, but I'm good beyond imagining. And I so shape and form you, if you will just let me get my hands around the clay of your life, that you have no idea how I can work, yes, through your strengths, but even more so through your weaknesses. For as Paul will write later in this epistle, 3 times he pleaded with the Lord to remove a thorn from his side, but the Lord said no. Why? For my grace is sufficient for you, and my power is made perfect in weakness. Do not give up on the God who never gives up on you. Secondly, this is really clear methodology. Verse 7 is really clear. The clay jars are all about the truth that the glory comes from Jesus. If you never have those spiritual moments for which there's a really clear technical term, are you ready for it? I call it the O pants moment. You know, where you find yourself in a situation and you know that Jesus wants you to be there, but all you're really doing is going, oh, pants, I don't know what to say here. If you never have those oh pants moments, if you're never out of your depth, then you're probably not living by faith. Jesus calls you to go to the least, the lowest, and the last. I was at Christchurch. Do you know, I even had to make friends with people at Pembroke. It's extraordinary. Sorry, Oxford humor, but the point is, you are called to be out of your depth, to live with jars of clay, because the glory comes from Christ. Clay chips, and it hurts. But the reality is, we are not called to have plastic jars. Paul refers to the outward temptation, the kind of spin, if we were putting it in modern term, in verse 1 of this chapter, and it's really tempting to give a kind of successful gospel that's built on everything going right. I have to say to you, it's not the gospel I read in the scriptures. One of the things I love about Paul is his deep reality that this hurts. Let's be honest about it. The church is torn apart by sexuality at the moment, just by way of an example I'm not supposed to mention, but hey, I'm among friends. Please don't pretend that one side or other of the argument is easy. It's a plastic gospel. Truth is that those who love Jesus and love people will find themselves living in clay in the middle and getting it wrong just as often as we get it right. But somehow with Christ holding out one hand as he did on the cross and refusing to let go of the world, and holding out the other as he did on the cross and refusing to let go of the Father, and refusing to let go that in some way Christ might bring reconciliation and hope and peace, even through apparently irreconcilable positions, in order that all might know that they are accepted and loved and welcomed into the glorious gospel of Christ. But to do this takes extraordinary trust. Have I got time for one more story, Charlie? I was very happily vicar in Ripon about, 10, something like this, years ago. Been there 4 years, expected to stay there at least another 10, if not 15 or 20. Kids were happy at school, Lindsay had a wonderful job, and it could not have been a more exciting church with some of the stuff that was going on. And out of the blue, I got an invitation to apply to run a theological college in the other great university in England. So I applied, and there I was in Durham, being interviewed. And I have to say to you, it was completely unexpected as an invitation, and even more unexpected to be there being interviewed for this. I was hugely nervous, and I knew for a fact that I couldn't do the job in my own strength. So I arrived early, and it was snowing because it was December the 18th in Durham. And I tried to find somewhere warm to go and pray. You know, if you know Durham, and if you don't, why not? It's beautiful. I went into the cathedral, which is there. And it was absolutely full of schoolgirls practicing for their carol concert that night. So I went into the Galilee Chapel right at the back. And I knelt down on one of those kind of pews, because basically if you're in a church and you don't want people to talk to you, kneel in a pew and they'll assume you're praying and leave you to be. And so there I was kind of kneeling down. And a pew being a pew, you kind of have to have your hands out like this in front of you, at least if you're a charismatic, you do, I guess. If you're not, you can do what you like with your hands. So I was there almost as if I was receiving communion. And I had the most extraordinary experience, which I cannot explain to you and has never happened to me before or since. For as I knelt praying in the Galilee Chapel, I suddenly realized that I wasn't looking at the Galilee Chapel from kind of this high above the ground, or however high my eyes were. But I was looking at the Galilee Chapel from maybe 15 or 20 feet up in the air. And in the same moment as my brain said to me, this is weird, I looked down expecting to see myself kneeling, and I realized that what I was seeing was a young woman dressed in a light blue kind of dressy thing. And the horrific thought went through my mind, I'm just about to be interviewed to be the principal of an evangelical theological college, and I'm having a vision of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And as that went through my mind, because the human reality when you encounter God powerfully is all sorts of muddled up, I heard the voice of God say to me, Will you let me birth within you that which is beyond you? Will you let me birth within you that which is beyond you? And I carried on praying, and I went for the most extraordinary interview experience, in which I managed to find 5 minutes or so to ring the family. And so I stood on the stairs outside the senior common room at St. John's College within which Cramner Hall, and just for the record, I was vice principal of John's College and warden of Cramner Hall, lest David Wilkinson ever hears this sermon and wrongly ascribes to me as being principal. I was standing outside at the SCR on the stairs, and I rang the kids, and they don't mind me telling you this story so long as I don't say who said what. So one of them said to me, and they would have been, I don't know, 9, 10, something like that, still at junior school, both of them at the time. And so they said, what's Jesus been saying to you today, Daddy? I have to say, I just love the fact that kids grasp that that's the reality of it, that we have extraordinary treasure and it's in jars of clay. What's Jesus been saying to you today, Daddy? And so I told them this story. And the response came down the line, I love the fact it's Christmas, so he can talk to you in this way. And I thought to myself, if you talk to Julian of Norwich, I think you can have visions of the Blessed Virgin at any time. But anyway, I didn't say that. I said, what's Jesus been saying to you today? And I heard the disappointment in the way that you can hear in the voice of one that you love with your whole heart coming down the telephone line or through the airwaves, of course. And the person said this to me, Daddy, I have been at school all day today. And I've been talking to Jesus about this. And all he has said to me is, trust, 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 trust. And I stood on the stairs of a theological college of the Church of England, trying not to weep, as my sub-10-year-old child had just nailed discipleship for me in 4 words with disappointment in their voice because they felt like they'd not yet grasped it. And I knew that if I ever went to Cramner Hall and if I ever had a message to give to the church, it was summed up in those 4 words, trust, 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 trust. You have extraordinary treasure, all of you. It's Jesus Christ. He's given you great gifts, but they pale into insignificance compared to the glory of God made known in Christ Jesus. He wraps it in forgiveness, which is made certain by his blood, and then he sends you out from here to your workplaces, to your homes, to your colleges, to your schools, to wherever you happen to be, and then beyond this to the very ends of the earth, to the least and the lowest and the lost. He sends you to those places where you are so far out of your depth that you barely begin to know how to start. And he says, will you trust me? For if you will, we can transform the worlds. And you may well find you're oppressed on every side, but you will not be crushed. That you carry in your body the death of Christ, and in so doing, discover its life for others. So where do we land? Well, I wonder if there are some here this morning who have never fully realized that this treasure is for you, or who have always worked with the thinking that you need to earn it. And Christ wants to stand here this morning with scarred hands outstretched to you and say, come, my child. It's about trust, and you are more welcome than you can possibly imagine. Charlie will lead us in a moment. Come and respond. For some of you, have a really clear sense that the Lord is tapping on your heart because you're living in fear of what he might ask you to do. And he wants to say to you, do you know, I have got more than you can yet begin to imagine. You will be out of your depths in ways that you haven't yet begun to glimpse. But do you know, I'm already there. And it's in those oh pants moments that you will discover what it is truly to carry treasure in jars of clay. And today is a day of liberation, of setting the captives free in order that the captives might be set free. And if you are bound with fear this morning, I just want to encourage you to come. Because my experience is there is barely a bigger Wazzack in the Church of England than me. Can I say the word Wazzack? But God works his grace even through me. For I'm a sinner saved by grace, and I've just begun to experience what it is to carry this treasure in jars of clay. God bless you all.